Chapter 1. Less bread. More taxes. And then all the people cheered again, and one man, who was more excited than the rest, flung his hat high into the air, and shouted, as well as I could make out, "Hurrah for the subwarden!" Everybody roared, but whether it was for the subwarden, or not, did not clearly appear. Some were shouting bread. And some taxes, but no one seemed to know what it was they really wanted. All this I saw from the open window of the warden's breakfast saloon, looking across the shoulder of the Lord Chancellor, who had sprung to his feet the moment the shouting began, almost as if he had been expecting it, and had rushed to the window which commanded the best view of the marketplace. "What can it all mean?" he kept repeating to himself, as, with his hands clasped behind him, and his gown floating in the air, he paced rapidly up and down the room. "I never heard such shouting before, and at this time of the morning, too. And with such unanimity. Doesn't it strike you as very remarkable?" I represented, modestly, that to my ears it appeared that they were shouting for different things, but the Chancellor would not listen to my suggestion for a moment. "They all shout the same words, I assure you," he said. Then, leaning well out of the window, he whispered to a man who was standing close underneath, "Keep 'em together, see, ain't you? The warden will be here directly. Give him the signal for the march up." All this was evidently not meant for my ears, but I could scarcely help hearing it, considering that my chin was almost on the Chancellor's shoulder. The march up was a very curious sight. A straggling procession of men, marching two and two, began from the other side of the marketplace, and advanced in an irregular zigzag fashion towards the palace, wildly tacking from side to side, like a sailing vessel making way against an unfavorable wind, so that the head of the procession was often further from us at the end of one tack than it had been at the end of the previous one. Yet it was evident that all was being done under orders, for I noticed that all eyes were fixed on the man who stood just under the window, and to whom the Chancellor was continually whispering. This man held his hat in one hand and a little green flag in the other. Whenever he waved the flag, the procession advanced a little nearer; when he dipped it, they sidled a little farther off, and whenever he waved his hat, they all raised a hoarse cheer. "Hurrah!" they cried, carefully keeping time with the hat as it bobbed up and down. "Hurrah! No! Consti! Tushun! Less! Bread! More! Taxes!" "That'll do, that'll do," the Chancellor whispered. "Let him rest a bit till I give you the word. He's not here yet." But at this moment the great folding doors of the saloon were flung open, and he turned with a guilty start to receive His High Excellency. However, it was only Bruno, and the Chancellor gave a little gasp of relieved anxiety. "Morning," said the little fellow, addressing the remark, in a general sort of way, to the Chancellor and the waiters. "Does you know where Sylvie is? I's looking for Sylvie." "She's with the warden, I believe, your Rhines," the Chancellor replied with a low bow. There was, no doubt, a certain amount of absurdity in applying this title, which, as of course you see without my telling you, was nothing but Your Royal Highness condensed into one syllable, to a small creature whose father was merely the warden of Outland. Still, large excuse must be made for a man who had passed several years at the court of Fairyland, and had there acquired the almost impossible art of pronouncing five syllables as one. But the bow was lost upon Bruno, who had run out of the room, even while the great feat of the unpronounceable monosyllable was being triumphantly performed. Just then, a single voice in the distance was understood to shout a speech from the Chancellor. "Certainly, my friends," the Chancellor replied with extraordinary promptitude. "You shall have a speech." Here one of the waiters, who had been for some minutes busy making a queer-looking mixture of egg and sherry, respectfully presented it on a large silver salver. The Chancellor took it haughtily, drank it off thoughtfully, smiled benevolently on the happy waiter as he set down the empty glass, and began. To the best of my recollection, this is what he said. "Ahem. Ahem. Ahem. Fellow sufferers, or rather suffering fellows, don't call 'em names," muttered the man under the window. "I didn't say felons," the Chancellor explained. "You may be sure that I always simpa, ear, ear," shouted the crowd, so loudly as quite to drown the orator's thin squeaky voice. "That I always simpa," he repeated. "Don't simper quite so much," said the man under the window. "It makes you look a hideot." And, all this time, "ear, ear," went rumbling round the marketplace, like a peal of thunder. "That I always sympathize," yelled the Chancellor, the first moment there was silence. "But your true friend is the subwarden. Day and night he is brooding on your wrongs, I should say your rights, that is to say your wrongs, no, I mean your rights, don't talk no more," growled the man under the window. "You're making a mess of it." At this moment the subwarden entered the saloon. He was a thin man, with a mean and crafty face, and a greenish-yellow complexion, and he crossed the room very slowly, looking suspiciously about him as if he thought there might be a savage dog hidden somewhere. "Bravo!" he cried, patting the Chancellor on the back. "You did that speech very well indeed. Why, you're a born orator, man." "Oh, that's nothing," the Chancellor replied, modestly, with downcast eyes. "Most orators are born, you know." The subwarden thoughtfully rubbed his chin. "Why, so they are," he admitted. "I never considered it in that light. Still, you did it very well. A word in your ear." The rest of their conversation was all in whispers, so, as I could hear no more, I thought I would go and find Bruno. I found the little fellow standing in the passage, and being addressed by one of the men in livery, who stood before him, nearly bent double from extreme respectfulness, with his hands hanging in front of him like the fins of a fish. "His High Excellency," this respectful man was saying, "is in his study, Your Reins." He didn't pronounce this quite so well as the Chancellor, thither Bruno trotted, and I thought it well to follow him. The warden, a tall dignified man with a grave but very pleasant face, was seated before a writing table, which was covered with papers, and holding on his knee one of the sweetest and loveliest little maidens it has ever been my lot to see. She looked 4 or 5 years older than Bruno, but she had the same rosy cheeks and sparkling eyes, and the same wealth of curly brown hair. Her eager smiling face was turned upwards towards her father's, and it was a pretty sight to see the mutual love with which the two faces, one in the spring of life, the other in its late autumn, were gazing on each other. "No, you've never seen him," the old man was saying, "you couldn't, you know, he's been away so long, traveling from land to land, and seeking for health, more years than you've been alive, little Sylvie." Here Bruno climbed upon his other knee, and a good deal of kissing, on a rather complicated system, was the result. "He only came back last night," said the warden, "when the kissing was over. He's been traveling post-haste, for the last 1,000 miles or so, in order to be here on Sylvie's birthday. But he's a very early riser, and I dare say he's in the library already. Come with me and see him. He's always kind to children. You'll be sure to like him." "Has the other professor come too?" Bruno asked in an awestruck voice. "Yes, they arrived together. The other professor as well. You won't like him quite so much, perhaps. He's a little more dreamy, you know." "I wish Sylvie was a little more dreamy," said Bruno.
"What do you mean, Bruno?" said Sylvie.
Bruno went on addressing his father. "She says she see ain't, oo no. But I thinks it isn't see ain't, it's won't e.
Says she see ain't dream," the puzzled warden repeated.
"She do say it," Bruno persisted. "When I says to her let's stop lessons, she says oh, I see ain't dream of letting you stop yet."
"He always wants to stop lessons," Sylvie explained, 5 minutes after we begin.
5 minutes lessons a day," said the warden. "You won't learn much at that rate, little man."
"That's just what Sylvie says," Bruno rejoined. "She says I won't learn my lessons. And I tells her, over and over, I see ain't learn 'em.
And what do you think she says?
She says it isn't see ain't, it's won't."
"Let's go and see the professor," the warden said, wisely avoiding further discussion. The children got down off his knees, each secured a hand, and the happy trio set off for the library, followed by me. I had come to the conclusion by this time that none of the party, except, for a few moments, the Lord Chancellor, was in the least able to see me.
"What's the matter with him?" Sylvie asked, walking with a little extra sedateness, by way of example to Bruno at the other side, who never ceased jumping up and down.
"What was the matter but I hope he's all right now was lumbago, and rheumatism, and that kind of thing. He's been curing himself, you know, he's a very learned doctor. Why, he's actually invented 3 new diseases, besides a new way of breaking your collarbone."
"Is it a nice way?" said Bruno.
"Well, not very," the warden said, as we entered the library. "And here is the professor.
Good morning, professor. Hope you're quite rested after your journey."
A jolly-looking, fat little man, in a flowery dressing gown, with a large book under each arm, came trotting in at the other end of the room, and was going straight across without taking any notice of the children.
"I'm looking for Volume 3," he said. "Do you happen to have seen it?"
"You don't see my children, professor," the warden exclaimed, taking him by the shoulders and turning him round to face them. The professor laughed violently, then he gazed at them through his great spectacles, for a minute or two, without speaking. At last he addressed Bruno. "I hope you have had a good night, my child?" Bruno looked puzzled.
"I's had the same night you've had," he replied. There's only been one night since yesterday. It was the professor's turn to look puzzled now. He took off his spectacles and rubbed them with his handkerchief. Then he gazed at them again. Then he turned to the warden. Are they bound? He inquired. No, we aren't, said Bruno, who thought himself quite able to answer this question. The professor shook his head sadly. Not even half bound? Why would we be half bound? Said Bruno. We're not prisoners. But the professor had forgotten all about them by this time, and was speaking to the warden again. You'll be glad to hear, he was saying, that the barometer's beginning to move. Well, which way? Said the warden, adding, to the children, not that I care, you know. Only he thinks it affects the weather. He's a wonderfully clever man, you know. Sometimes he says things that only the other professor can understand. Sometimes he says things that nobody can understand. Which way is it, professor? Up or down? Neither. Said the professor, gently clapping his hands. It's going sideways, if I may so express myself. And what kind of weather does that produce? Said the warden. Listen, children. Now you'll hear something worth knowing. Horizontal weather, said the professor, and made straight for the door, very nearly trampling on Bruno, who had only just time to get out of his way. Isn't he learned? The warden said, looking after him with admiring eyes. Positively he runs over with learning. But he needn't run over me, said Bruno. The professor was back in a moment. He had changed his dressing gown for a frock coat, and had put on a pair of very strange-looking boots, the tops of which were open umbrellas. I thought you'd like to see them, he said. These are the boots for horizontal weather. But what's the use of wearing umbrellas round one's knees? In ordinary rain, the professor admitted, they would not be of much use. But if ever it rained horizontally, you know, they would be invaluable, simply invaluable. Take the professor to the breakfast saloon, children, said the warden. And tell them not to wait for me. I had breakfast early, as I've some business to attend to. The children seized the professor's hands, as familiarly as if they had known him for years, and hurried him away. I followed respectfully behind. Chapter 2. La Mian Canoe. As we entered the breakfast saloon, the professor was saying, and he had breakfast by himself, early, so he begged you wouldn't wait for him, my lady. This way, my lady, he added, this way. And then, with, as it seemed to me, most superfluous politeness, he flung open the door of my compartment, and ushered in a young and lovely lady. I muttered to myself with some bitterness. And this is, of course, the opening scene of Volume 1. She is the heroine. And I am one of those subordinate characters that only turn up when needed for the development of her destiny, and whose final appearance is outside the church, waiting to greet the happy pair. Yes, my lady, change of Fayfield, were the next words I heard. Oh, the too obsequious guard, next station but one. And the door closed, and the lady settled down into her corner, and the monotonous throb of the engine, making one feel as if the train were some gigantic monster, whose very circulation we could feel, proclaimed that we were once more speeding on our way. The lady had a perfectly formed nose, I caught myself saying to myself, hazel eyes, and lips, and here it occurred to me that to see, for myself, what the lady was really like, would be more satisfactory than much speculation. I looked round cautiously, and was entirely disappointed of my hope. The veil, which shrouded her whole face, was too thick for me to see more than the glitter of bright eyes and the hazy outline of what might be a lovely oval face, but might also, unfortunately, be an equally unlovely one. I closed my eyes again, saying to myself, couldn't have a better chance for an experiment in telepathy? I'll think out her face, and afterwards test the portrait with the original. At first, no result at all crowned my efforts, though I divided my swift mind, now hither, now thither, in a way that I felt sure would have made Aeneas green with envy, but the dimly seen oval remained as provokingly blank as ever a mere ellipse, as if in some mathematical diagram, without even the foci that might be made to do duty as a nose and a mouth. Gradually, however, the conviction came upon me that I could, by a certain concentration of thought, think the veil away, and so get a glimpse of the mysterious face as to which the two questions, is she pretty? And is she plain? Still hung suspended, in my mind, in beautiful equipoise. Success was partial and fitful, still there was a result, ever and anon, the veil seemed to vanish, in a sudden flash of light, but, before I could fully realize the face, all was dark again. In each such glimpse, the face seemed to grow more childish and more innocent, and, when I had at last thought the veil entirely away, it was, unmistakably, the sweet face of little Sylvie. So, either I've been dreaming about Sylvie, I said to myself, and this is the reality. Or else I've really been with Sylvie, and this is a dream. Is life itself a dream, I wonder? To occupy the time, I got out the letter, which had caused me to take this sudden railway journey from my London home down to a strange fishing town on the north coast, and read it over again, dash. Dear old friend. I'm sure it will be as great a pleasure to me, as it can possibly be to you, to meet once more after so many years, and of course I shall be ready to give you all the benefit of such medical skill as I have, only, you know, one mustn't violate professional etiquette. And you are already in the hands of a first-rate London doctor, with whom it would be utter affectation for me to pretend to compete. I make no doubt he is right in saying the heart is affected, all your symptoms point that way. One thing, at any rate, I have already done in my doctoral capacity secured you a bedroom on the ground floor, so that you will not need to ascend the stairs at all. I shall expect you by last train on Friday, in accordance with your letter, and, till then, I shall say, in the words of the old song, oh for Friday nicht. Friday's lang a coming. Yours always. Arthur Forrester. P.S. Do you believe in fate? This postscript puzzled me sorely. He is far too sensible a man, I thought, to have become a fatalist. And yet what else can he mean by it? And, as I folded up the letter and put it away, I inadvertently repeated the words aloud. Do you believe in fate? The fair incognita turned her head quickly at the sudden question. No, I don't. She said with a smile. Do you? I didn't mean to ask the question. I stammered, a little taken aback at having begun a conversation in so unconventional a fashion. The lady's smile became a laugh, not a mocking laugh, but the laugh of a happy child who is perfectly at her ease. Didn't you? She said. Then it was a case of what you doctors call unconscious cerebration? I am no doctor, I replied. Do I look so like one? Or what makes you think it? She pointed to the book I had been reading, which was so lying that its title, Diseases of the Heart, was plainly visible. One needn't be a doctor, I said, to take an interest in medical books. There's another class of readers, who are yet more deeply interested. You mean the patients? She interrupted, while a look of tender pity gave new sweetness to her face. But, with an evident wish to avoid a possibly painful topic, one needn't be either, to take an interest in books of science. Which contain the greatest amount of science, do you think, the books, or the minds? Rather a profound question for a lady. I said to myself, holding, with the conceit so natural to man, that woman's intellect is essentially shallow. And I considered a minute before replying. If you mean living minds, I don't think it's possible to decide. There is so much written science that no living person has ever read, and there is so much thought-out science that hasn't yet been written. But, if you mean the whole human race, then I think the minds have it, everything, recorded in books, must have once been in some mind, you know. Isn't that rather like one of the rules in algebra? My lady inquired. Algebra too. I thought with increasing wonder, I mean, if we consider thoughts as factors, may we not say that the least common multiple of all the minds contains that of all the books, but not the other way? Certainly we may. I replied, delighted with the illustration. And what a grand thing it would be, I went on dreamily, thinking aloud rather than talking, if we could only apply that rule to books. You know, in finding the least common multiple, we strike out a quantity wherever it occurs, except in the term where it is raised to its highest power. So we should have to erase every recorded thought, except in the sentence where it is expressed with the greatest intensity. My lady laughed merrily. Some books would be reduced to blank paper, I'm afraid. She said. They would. Most libraries would be terribly diminished in bulk. But just think what they would gain in quality. When will it be done? She eagerly asked. If there's any chance of it in my time, I think I'll leave off reading, and wait for it. Well, perhaps in another 1,000 years or so. Then there's no use waiting, said my lady. Let's sit down. Ugh, my pet, come and sit by me. Anywhere but by me, growled the subwarden. The little wretch always manages to upset his coffee. I guessed at once, as perhaps the reader will also have guessed, if, like myself, he is very clever at drawing conclusions, that my lady was the subwarden's wife, and that Ugh, a hideous fat boy, about the same age as Sylvie, with the expression of a prize pig, was their son. Sylvie and Bruno, with the Lord Chancellor, made up a party of 7. And you actually got a plunge bath every morning? Said the subwarden, seemingly in continuation of a conversation with the professor. Even at the little roadside inns? Oh, certainly, certainly. The professor replied with a smile on his jolly face. Allow me to explain. It is, in fact, a very simple problem in hydrodynamics. That means a combination of water and strength. If we take a plunge bath, and a man of great strength, such as myself, about to plunge into it, we have a perfect example of this science. I am bound to admit, the professor continued, in a lower tone and with downcast eyes, that we need a man of remarkable strength. He must be able to spring from the floor to about twice his own height, gradually turning over as he rises, so as to come down again head first. Why, you need a flea, not a man! Exclaimed the subwarden. Pardon me, said the professor. This particular kind of bath is not adapted for a flea. Let us suppose, he continued, folding his table napkin into a graceful festoon, that this represents what is perhaps the necessity of this age, the active tourist's portable bath. You may describe it briefly, if you like, looking at the Chancellor, by the letters ATPB. The Chancellor, much disconcerted at finding everybody looking at him, could only murmur, in a shy whisper, precisely so. One great advantage of this plunge bath, continued the professor, is that it requires only half a gallon of water. I don't call it a plunge bath, his sub-excellency remarked, unless your active tourist goes right under. But he does go right under, the old man gently replied. The AT hangs up the P.B. on a nail thus. He then empties the water jug into it, places the empty jug below the bag, leaps into the air, descends head first into the bag, the water rises round him to the top of the bag, and there you are. He triumphantly concluded. The AT is as much underwater as if he'd gone a mile or two down into the Atlantic. And he's drowned, let us say, in about 4 minutes. By no means. The professor answered with a proud smile. After about a minute, he quietly turns a tap at the lower end of the P.B. All the water runs back into the jug and there you are again. But how in the world is he to get out of the bag again? That, I take it, said the professor, is the most beautiful part of the whole invention. All the way up the PB, inside, are loops for the thumbs, so it's something like going upstairs, only perhaps less comfortable, and, by the time the AT has risen out of the bag, all but his head, he's sure to topple over, one way or the other the law of gravity secures that. And there he is on the floor again. A little bruised, perhaps? Well, yes, a little bruised, but having had his plunge bath, that's the great thing. Wonderful. It's almost beyond belief, murmured the subwarden. The professor took it as a compliment, and bowed with a gratified smile. Quite beyond belief. My lady added, meaning, no doubt, to be more complimentary still. The professor bowed, but he didn't smile this time. I can assure you, he said earnestly, that, provided the bath was made, I used it every morning. I certainly ordered it, that I am clear about. My only doubt is, whether the man ever finished making it. It's difficult to remember, after so many years. At this moment the door, very slowly and creakingly, began to open, and Sylvie and Bruno jumped up, and ran to meet the well-known footstep. Chapter 3. Birthday Presents. It's my brother! The subwarden exclaimed, in a warning whisper. Speak out, and be quick about it. The appeal was evidently addressed to the Lord Chancellor, who instantly replied, in a shrill monotone, like a little boy repeating the alphabet, as I was remarking, Your Sub-Excellency, this portentous movement. You began too soon. The other interrupted, scarcely able to restrain himself to a whisper, so great was his excitement. He couldn't have heard you. Begin again. As I was remarking, chanted the obedient Lord Chancellor, this portentous movement has already assumed the dimensions of a revolution. And what are the dimensions of a revolution? The voice was genial and mellow, and the face of the tall dignified old man, who had just entered the room, leading Sylvie by the hand, and with Bruno riding triumphantly on his shoulder, was too noble and gentle to have scared a less guilty man. But the Lord Chancellor turned pale instantly, and could hardly articulate the words, the dimensions, your High Excellency. I scarcely comprehend. Well, the length, breadth, and thickness, if you like it better. And the old man smiled, half contemptuously. The Lord Chancellor recovered himself with a great effort, and pointed to the open window. If your High Excellency will listen for a moment to the shouts of the exasperated populace, of the exasperated populace. The subwarden repeated in a louder tone, as the Lord Chancellor, being in a state of abject terror, had dropped almost into a whisper, you will understand what it is they want. And at that moment there surged into the room a hoarse confused cry, in which the only clearly audible words were less bread, more taxes. The old man laughed heartily. What in the world he was beginning, but the Chancellor heard him not. Some mistake. He muttered, hurrying to the window, from which he shortly returned with an air of relief. Now listen. He exclaimed, holding up his hand impressively. And now the words came quite distinctly, and with the regularity of the ticking of a clock, more bread, less taxes. More bread. The warden repeated in astonishment. Why, the new government bakery was opened only last week, and I gave orders to sell the bread at cost price during the present scarcity. What can they expect more? The bakery's closed, Your Reins. The Chancellor said, more loudly and clearly than he had spoken yet. He was emboldened by the consciousness that here, at least, he had evidence to produce, and he placed in the warden's hands a few printed notices, that were lying ready, with some open ledgers, on a side table. Yes, yes, I see. The warden muttered, glancing carelessly through them. Order countermanded by my brother, and supposed to be my doing. Rather sharp practice. It's all right. He added in a louder tone. My name is signed to it, so I take it on myself. But what do they mean by less taxes? How can they be less? I abolished the last of them a month ago. It's been put on again, Your Reins, and by Your Reins's own orders, and other printed notices were submitted for inspection. The warden, whilst looking them over, glanced once or twice at the subwarden, who had seated himself before one of the open ledgers, and was quite absorbed in adding it up, but he merely repeated it's all right. I accept it as my doing. And they do say, the Chancellor went on sheepishly, looking much more like a convicted thief than an officer of state, that a change of government, by the abolition of the subwarden, I mean, he hastily added, on seeing the warden's look of astonishment, the abolition of the office of subwarden, and giving the present holder the right to act as vice-warden whenever the warden is absent would appease all this seething discontent. I mean, he added, glancing at a paper he held in his hand, all this seething discontent. For 15 years, put in a deep but very harsh voice, my husband has been acting as subwarden. It is too long. It is much too long. My lady was a vast creature at all times, but, when she frowned and folded her arms, as now, she looked more gigantic than ever, and made one try to fancy what a haystack would look like, if out of temper. He would distinguish himself as a vice. My lady proceeded, being far too stupid to see the double meaning of her words. There has been no such vice in Outland for many a long year, as he would be. What course would you suggest, sister? The warden mildly inquired. My lady stamped, which was undignified, and snorted, which was ungraceful. This is no jesting matter. She bellowed. I will consult my brother, said the warden. Brother. And 7 makes 194, which is 16 and tuppence, the subwarden replied. Put down 2 and carry 16. The Chancellor raised his hands and eyebrows, lost in admiration. Such a man of business. He murmured. Brother, could I have a word with you in my study? The warden said in a louder tone. The subwarden rose with alacrity, and the two left the room together. My lady turned to the professor, who had uncovered the urn, and was taking its temperature with his pocket thermometer. Professor. She began, so loudly and suddenly that even Ugug, who had gone to sleep in his chair, left off snoring and opened one eye. The professor pocketed his thermometer in a moment, clasped his hands, and put his head on one side with a meek smile. You were teaching my son before breakfast, I believe? My lady loftily remarked. I hope he strikes you as having talent? Oh, very much so indeed, my lady. The professor hastily replied, unconsciously rubbing his ear, while some painful recollection seemed to cross his mind. I was very forcibly struck by his magnificence, I assure you. He is a charming boy. My lady exclaimed. Even his snores are more musical than those of other boys. If that were so, the professor seemed to think, the snores of other boys must be something too awful to be endured, but he was a cautious man, and he said nothing. And he's so clever. My lady continued. No one will enjoy your lecture more, by the way, have you fixed the time for it yet? You've never given one, you know, and it was promised years ago, before you. Yes, yes, my lady, I know. Perhaps next Tuesday or Tuesday week. That will do very well, said my lady, graciously. Of course you will let the other professor lecture as well? I think not, my lady. The professor said with some hesitation. You see, he always stands with his back to the audience. It does very well for reciting, but for lecturing. You are quite right, said my lady. And, now I come to think of it, there would hardly be time for more than one lecture. And it will go off all the better, if we begin with a banquet, and a fancy dress ball. It will indeed. The professor cried, with enthusiasm. I shall come as a grasshopper, my lady calmly proceeded. What shall you come as, professor? The professor smiled feebly. I shall come as early as I can, my lady. You mustn't come in before the doors are opened, said my lady. I see ain't, said the professor. Excuse me a moment. As this is Lady Sylvie's birthday, I would like to, and he rushed away. Bruno began feeling in his pockets, looking more and more melancholy as he did so, then he put his thumb in his mouth, and considered for a minute, then he quietly left the room. He had hardly done so before the professor was back again, quite out of breath. Wishing you many happy returns of the day, my dear child. He went on, addressing the smiling little girl, who had run to meet him. Allow me to give you a birthday present. It's a second-hand pincushion, my dear. And it only cost fourpence halfpenny. Thank you, it's very pretty. And Sylvie rewarded the old man with a hearty kiss. And the pins they gave me for nothing. The professor added in high glee. 15 of them, and only one bent. I'll make the bent one into a hook, said Sylvie. To catch Bruno with, when he runs away from his lessons. You see ain't guess what my present is, said Ugg, who had taken the butter dish from the table, and was standing behind her, with a wicked leer on his face. No, I see ain't guess, Sylvie said without looking up. She was still examining the professor's pincushion. It's this, cried the bad boy, exultingly, as he emptied the dish over her, and then, with a grin of delight at his own cleverness, looked round for applause. Sylvie colored crimson, as she shook off the butter from her frock, but she kept her lips tight shut, and walked away to the window, where she stood looking out and trying to recover her temper. Ugg's triumph was a very short one. The subwarden had returned, just in time to be a witness of his dear child's playfulness, and in another moment a skillfully applied box on the ear had changed the grin of delight into a howl of pain. My darling! Cried his mother, enfolding him in her fat arms. Did they box his ears for nothing? A precious pet. It's not for nothing, growled the angry father. Are you aware, madam, that I pay the house bills, out of a fixed annual sum? The loss of all that wasted butter falls on me. Do you hear, madam? Hold your tongue, sir. My lady spoke very quietly, almost in a whisper. But there was something in her look which silenced him. Don't you see it was only a joke? And a very clever one, too. He only meant that he loved nobody but her. And, instead of being pleased with the compliment, the spiteful little thing has gone away in a huff. The subwarden was a very good hand at changing a subject. He walked across to the window. My dear, he said, is that a pig that I see down below, rooting about among your flower beds? A pig! Shrieked my lady, rushing madly to the window, and almost pushing her husband out, in her anxiety to see for herself. Whose pig is it? How did it get in? Where's that crazy gardener gone? At this moment Bruno re-entered the room, and passing Ugg, who was blubbering his loudest, in the hope of attracting notice, as if he was quite used to that sort of thing, he ran up to Sylvie and threw his arms round her. I went to my toy cupboard, he said with a very sorrowful face, to see if there were somethin' fit for a present fru. And there isn't nothin'. They's all broken, every one. And I haven't got no money left, to buy you a birthday present. And I see ain't give you nothin' but this. This was a very earnest hug and a kiss. Oh, thank you, darling! Cried Sylvie. I like your present best of all. But if so, why did she give it back so quickly? His sub-excellency turned and patted the two children on the head with his long lean hands. Go away, dears! He said. There's business to talk over. Sylvie and Bruno went away hand in hand, but, on reaching the door, Sylvie came back again and went up to Ugg timidly. I don't mind about the butter, she said, and I'm sorry he hurt you. And she tried to shake hands with the little ruffian, but Ugg only blubbered louder, and wouldn't make friends. Sylvie left the room with a sigh. The subwarden glared angrily at his weeping son. Leave the room, Sirrah! He said, as loud as he dared. His wife was still leaning out of the window, and kept repeating I see ain't see that pig. Where is it? It's moved to the right now, it's gone a little to the left, said the subwarden, but he had his back to the window, and was making signals to the Lord Chancellor, pointing to Ugg in the door, with many a cunning nod and wink. The Chancellor caught his meaning at last, and, crossing the room, took that interesting child by the ear. The next moment he and Ugg were out of the room, and the door shut behind them, but not before one piercing yell had rung through the room, and reached the ears of the fond mother. What is that hideous noise? She fiercely asked, turning upon her startled husband. "It's some hyena or other," replied the subwarden, looking vaguely up to the ceiling, as if that was where they usually were to be found. "Let us to business, my dear. Here comes the warden." And he picked up from the floor a wandering scrap of manuscript, on which I just caught the words "after which election duly holden the said Sibamet and Tabakot his wife may at their pleasure assume imperial" before, with a guilty look, he crumpled it up in his hand. Chapter 4. A Cunning Conspiracy. The warden entered at this moment, and close behind him came the Lord Chancellor, a little flushed and out of breath, and adjusting his wig, which appeared to have been dragged partly off his head. "But where is my precious child?" my lady inquired, as the four took their seats at the small side table devoted to ledgers and bundles and bills. "He left the room a few minutes ago with the Lord Chancellor," the subwarden briefly explained. "Ah," said my lady, graciously smiling on that high official. "Your lordship has a very taking way with children. I doubt if anyone could gain the ear of my darling Ugug so quickly as you can." For an entirely stupid woman, my lady's remarks were curiously full of meaning, of which she herself was wholly unconscious. The Chancellor bowed, but with a very uneasy air. "I think the warden was about to speak," he remarked, evidently anxious to change the subject. But my lady would not be checked. "He is a clever boy," she continued with enthusiasm, "but he needs a man like your lordship to draw him out." The Chancellor bit his lip, and was silent. He evidently feared that, stupid as she looked, she understood what she said this time, and was having a joke at his expense. He might have spared himself all anxiety, whatever accidental meaning her words might have, she herself never meant anything at all. "It is all settled," the warden announced, wasting no time over preliminaries. "The subwardenship is abolished, and my brother is appointed to act as vice-warden whenever I am absent. So, as I am going abroad for a while, he will enter on his new duties at once." "And there will really be a vice after all?" my lady inquired. "I hope so," the warden smilingly replied. My lady looked much pleased, and tried to clap her hands, "but you might as well have knocked two featherbeds together, for any noise it made. When my husband is vice," she said, "it will be the same as if we had 100 vices." "Hear, hear," cried the subwarden. "You seem to think it very remarkable," my lady remarked with some severity, "that your wife should speak the truth." "No, not remarkable at all," her husband anxiously explained. "Nothing is remarkable that you say, sweet one." My lady smiled approval of the sentiment, and went on. "And am I vice-wardeness?" "If you choose to use that title," said the warden, "but your excellency will be the proper style of address. And I trust that both his excellency and her excellency will observe the agreement I have drawn up. The provision I am most anxious about is this." He unrolled a large parchment scroll, and read aloud the words "item, that we will be kind to the poor." "The Chancellor worded it for me," he added, glancing at the great functionary. "I suppose, now, that word item has some deep legal meaning?"
"Undoubtedly," replied the Chancellor, as articulately as he could with a pen between his lips. He was nervously rolling and unrolling several other scrolls, and making room among them for the one the warden had just handed to him. "These are merely the rough copies," he explained, "and, as soon as I have put in the final corrections making a great commotion among the different parchments, a semicolon or two that I have accidentally omitted here," he darted about, pen in hand, from one part of the scroll to another, spreading sheets of blotting paper over his corrections, "all will be ready for signing."
"Should it not be read out, first?" my lady inquired.
"No need, no need," the subwarden and the Chancellor exclaimed at the same moment, with feverish eagerness.
"No need at all," the warden gently assented. "Your husband and I have gone through it together. It provides that he shall exercise the full authority of warden, and shall have the disposal of the annual revenue attached to the office, until my return, or, failing that, until Bruno comes of age, and that he shall then hand over, to myself or to Bruno as the case may be, the wardenship, the unspent revenue, and the contents of the treasury, which are to be preserved, intact, under his guardianship." All this time the subwarden was busy, with the Chancellor's help, shifting the papers from side to side, and pointing out to the warden the place few he was to sign. He then signed it himself, and my lady and the Chancellor added their names as witnesses.
"Short partings are best," said the warden. "All is ready for my journey. My children are waiting below to see me off." He gravely kissed my lady, shook hands with his brother and the Chancellor, and left the room. The three waited in silence till the sound of wheels announced that the warden was out of hearing, then, to my surprise, they broke into peals of uncontrollable laughter.
"What a game, oh, what a game!" cried the Chancellor. And he and the Vice Warden joined hands, and skipped wildly about the room. My lady was too dignified to skip, but she laughed like the neighing of a horse, and waved her handkerchief above her head. It was clear to her very limited understanding that something very clever had been done, but what it was she had yet to learn. "You said I should hear all about it when the warden had gone," she remarked, as soon as she could make herself heard. "And so you shall, Tabby," her husband graciously replied, as he removed the blotting paper, and showed the two parchments lying side by side. "This is the one he read but didn't sign, and this is the one he signed but didn't read. You see, it was all covered up, except the place for signing the names." "Yes, yes," my lady interrupted eagerly, and began comparing the two agreements. "Item, that he shall exercise the authority of warden, in the warden's absence. Why, that's been changed into shall be absolute governor for life, with the title of emperor, if elected to that office by the people." "What? Are you emperor, darling?" "Not yet, dear," the vice warden replied. "It won't do to let this paper be seen, just at present. All in good time." My lady nodded, and read on. "Item, that we will be kind to the poor." "Why, that's omitted altogether." "Course it is," said her husband. "We're not going to bother about the wretches." "Good," said my lady, with emphasis, and read on again. "Item, that the contents of the treasury be preserved intact." "Why, that's altered into shall be at the absolute disposal of the vice warden." "Well, Sibby, that was a clever trick. All the jewels, only think. May I go and put them on directly?" "Well, not just yet, lovey," her husband uneasily replied. "You see, the public mind isn't quite ripe for it yet. We must feel our way. Of course we'll have the coach and four out, at once. And I'll take the title of emperor, as soon as we can safely hold an election. But they'll hardly stand our using the jewels, as long as they know the warden's alive. We must spread a report of his death. A little conspiracy." "A conspiracy," cried the delighted lady, clapping her hands. "Of all things, I do like a conspiracy. It's so interesting." The vice warden and the chancellor interchanged a wink or two. "Let her conspire to her heart's content," the cunning chancellor whispered. "It'll do no harm." "And when will the conspiracy—" "Hist," her husband hastily interrupted her, as the door opened, and Sylvie and Bruno came in, with their arms twined lovingly round each other, Bruno sobbing convulsively, with his face hidden on his sister's shoulder, and Sylvie more grave and quiet, but with tears streaming down her cheeks. "Mustn't cry like that," the vice warden said sharply, but without any effect on the weeping children. "Cheer 'em up a bit," he hinted to my lady. "Cake," my lady muttered to herself with great decision, crossing the room and opening a cupboard, from which she presently returned with two slices of plum cake. "Eat, and don't cry," were her short and simple orders, and the poor children sat down side by side, but seemed in no mood for eating. For the second time the door opened, or rather was burst open, this time, as Ugug rushed violently into the room, shouting that old beggar's come again. "He's not to have any food," the vice warden was beginning, but the chancellor interrupted him. "It's all right," he said, in a low voice, "the servants have their orders." "He's just under here," said Ugug, who had gone to the window, and was looking down into the courtyard. "Where, my darling?" said his fond mother, flinging her arms round the neck of the little monster. All of us, except Sylvie and Bruno, who took no notice of what was going on, followed her to the window. The old beggar looked up at us with hungry eyes. "Only a crust of bread, your highness," he pleaded. He was a fine old man, but looked sadly ill and worn. "A crust of bread is what I crave," he repeated. "A single crust, and a little water. Here's some water, drink this." Ugug bellowed, emptying a jug of water over his head. "Well done, my boy," cried the vice warden. "That's the way to settle such folk." "Clever boy," the wardeness chimed in. "Hasn't he good spirits?" "Take a stick to him," shouted the vice warden, as the old beggar shook the water from his ragged cloak, and again gazed meekly upwards. "Take a red-hot poker to him," my lady again chimed in. Possibly there was no red-hot poker handy, but some sticks were forthcoming in a moment, and threatening faces surrounded the poor old wanderer, who waved them back with quiet dignity. "No need to break my old bones," he said. "I am going. Not even a crust." "Poor, poor old man," exclaimed a little voice at my side, half choked with sobs. Bruno was at the window, trying to throw out his slice of plum cake, but Sylvie held him back. "He shalt have my cake," Bruno cried, passionately struggling out of Sylvie's arms.
"Yes, yes, darling," Sylvie gently pleaded. "But don't throw it out. He's gone away, don't you see? Let's go after him." And she led him out of the room, unnoticed by the rest of the party, who were wholly absorbed in watching the old beggar.
The conspirators returned to their seats, and continued their conversation in an undertone, so as not to be heard by Ugug, who was still standing at the window.
"By the way, there was something about Bruno succeeding to the Raritanship," said my lady. "How does that stand in the new agreement?"
The Chancellor chuckled. "Just the same, word for word," he said, "with one exception, my lady. Instead of Bruno, I've taken the liberty to put in—" he dropped his voice to a whisper, "to put in Ugug, you know."
"Ugug, indeed," I exclaimed, in a burst of indignation I could no longer control. To bring out even that one word seemed a gigantic effort, but, the cry once uttered, all effort ceased at once. A sudden gust swept away the whole scene, and I found myself sitting up, staring at the young lady in the opposite corner of the carriage, who had now thrown back her veil, and was looking at me with an expression of amused surprise.
Chapter 5. A Beggar's Palace. That I had said something, in the act of waking, I felt sure. The hoarse stifled cry was still ringing in my ears, even if the startled look of my fellow traveler had not been evidence enough, but what could I possibly say by way of apology?
"I hope I didn't frighten you?" I stammered out at last. "I have no idea what I said. I was dreaming."
"You said Ugug indeed," the young lady replied, with quivering lips that would curve themselves into a smile, in spite of all her efforts to look grave. "At least you didn't say it, you shouted it."
"I'm very sorry," was all I could say, feeling very penitent and helpless. "She has Sylvie's eyes," I thought to myself, half doubting whether, even now, I were fairly awake. "And that sweet look of innocent wonder is all Sylvie's too. But Sylvie hasn't got that calm resolute mouth nor that far away look of dreamy sadness, like one that has had some deep sorrow, very long ago." And the thick coming fancies almost prevented my hearing the lady's next words.
"If you had had a shilling dreadful in your hand," she proceeded, "something about ghosts or dynamite or midnight murder, one could understand it. Those things aren't worth the shilling, unless they give one a nightmare. But really, with only a medical treatise, you know." And she glanced, with a pretty shrug of contempt, at the book over which I had fallen asleep. Her friendliness, and utter unreserve, took me aback for a moment, yet there was no touch of forwardness, or boldness, about the child for child, almost, she seemed to be. I guessed her at scarcely over 20. All was the innocent frankness of some angelic visitant, new to the ways of earth and the conventionalisms, or, if you will, the barbarisms of society. "Even so," I mused, "will Sylvie look and speak, in another 10 years?
"You don't care for ghosts, then," I ventured to suggest, "unless they are really terrifying?"
"Quite so," the lady assented. "The regular railway ghosts, I mean the ghosts of ordinary railway literature, are very poor affairs. I feel inclined to say, with Alexander Selkirk, their tameness is shocking to me. And they never do any midnight murders. They couldn't welter in gore, to save their lives."
"Weltering in gore is a very expressive phrase, certainly. Can it be done in any fluid, I wonder?"
"I think not," the lady readily replied, quite as if she had thought it out, long ago. "It has to be something thick. For instance, you might welter in bread sauce. That, being white, would be more suitable for a ghost, supposing it wished to welter."
"You have a real good terrifying ghost in that book?" I hinted.
"How could you guess?" she exclaimed with the most engaging frankness, and placed the volume in my hands. I opened it eagerly, with a not unpleasant thrill, like what a good ghost story gives one, at the uncanny coincidence of my having so unexpectedly divined the subject of her studies. It was a book of domestic cookery, open at the article bread sauce. I returned the book, looking, I suppose, a little blank, as the lady laughed merrily at my discomfiture. "It's far more exciting than some of the modern ghosts, I assure you. Now, there was a ghost last month, I don't mean a real ghost in Supernature, but in a magazine. It was a perfectly flavorless ghost. It wouldn't have frightened a mouse. It wasn't a ghost that one would even offer a chair to. 70 years, baldness, and spectacles, have their advantages after all," I said to myself.